This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 36 was recorded on July 22, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Julian Brigden from MI2 Partners is back with us today. Julian, things are happening a lot more quickly than ever before, and if, as some people say, central banks are powerless to respond to deflationary pressures, what are the implications for U.S. pension funds, or doesn't it matter in this 401k world?
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me back on the show. Look, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's funny, we, you know, just as a slight aside, we'd written last year about a couple of things that we were watching, and we assumed, we wrote them as sort of big picture pieces, big picture meaning they would unfold over a number of years. You know, one of them was the breaking down of the sort of US-Chinese relationship, Chimerica as it's referred to. And, you know, we discussed this last September, and we assumed that it would take 4, 5, 6, 10 years to sort of reach fruition. And yet, barely in that number of months, we almost seem to be at an impasse. You know, another one that we've been looking at is the demographic shift and how that would lead to a radicalization of politics and a significant shift in the tone of a lot of the factors that have been beneficial for investment in the US since the late 80s, when you sort of had Thatcherism and Reaganism. And yet, you know, if you look at the path that the Democrats seem to be going on within their debates, we're already at that tipping point. We're talking about universal healthcare. We're talking about potentially writing off student loans. We're talking about, you know, regulation for these tech companies. We're talking about a lot less sort of beneficial environment for capitalism. And if you look at that in the central bank sphere, one of the things that we'd discussed, or in with the process of discussing with clients, is, you know, this trend towards the zero lower bound and beyond that, negative interest rates. I mean, we've obviously seen that in Europe and to some extent in Japan. And, you know, a few years on, with the experience of hindsight, it does appear that some of the natural issues that would have held central bankers to crossing that Rubicon and moving into negative rates, experience has showed is potentially, and I say potentially because I'm far less convinced than they seem to be, less of an issue than they'd previously perceived. So the question is, does it happen here? And I think so far it would appear that, yes, to go to your original question, central bankers are incapable of generating inflation. And so we're still locked in these deflationary forces. I'm a little skeptical of that. I think it can be created, particularly in the United States, if we manage to weaken the dollar. But so far, that hasn't happened. And in that environment, and given that things are happening so incredibly rapidly, it is logical to start thinking, what are the consequences if the US is forced to follow the rest of the world down the rabbit hole of negative interest rates? And what does that mean for pension funds and so on and so forth? Well, I think the obvious answer is most pension schemes, certainly ones that are provided outside the 401k world, are going to be insolvent. You know, if you're a pensioner sitting in New Jersey and working for some state municipality, you should assume, because it's going to be nigh on impossible to increase those tax rates sufficiently to bail you out, that you may get a haircut. Now, I know it'll get dragged out in the courts and so on and so forth, but ultimately, those pension benefits will be unsupportable in an environment where bond yields are 50 basis points like they are in Europe, let alone negative, right? It just doesn't make sense. Maybe we can just inflate equity prices sufficiently. But as you can see, certainly as you've seen for most of this year, money has been flowing into fixed income and not into equity markets. In fact, most sort of pension funds seem to be de-risking, in other words, selling stocks and buying bonds. The whole assumptions, and this is where I think things fall radically apart, there's lots of assumptions that there's a linearity, right? That you can just go from, you know, interest rates of 5% to 3% to 2% to 1% to 0 to minus 1 to minus 2, and the world behaves in a linear way, doesn't appear to be the experience. So I think things can become, as I said, it's not my personal view right here, right now, that we are staring in the US at that potential abyss. But I think it's worth considering it because things are happening incredibly rapidly. And if, you know, if I'm wrong and we don't get a bout of kind of reflation and we can't weaken the dollar and we can't create the inflation that we need here in the US, then, yeah, we're going down that road. And you can hang out there for a while, but the consequences are just bloody dire.
Well, if the Fed cannot create inflation, I certainly have confidence in the MMTers and others who would like to engage in much more social spending.
And on that side, I definitively agree with you, Eric. I mean, I think trouble is it's 2021, right? It's post the election, realistically. But everything I'm hearing in DC on both sides suggests that fiscal spending supported by MMT is basically a done deal. I think the only thing that changes is who's in control and how that money gets spent.
Yeah, I think that those who are thinking inflation is impossible at this point should be careful what they wish for, because it will take longer than most people expect, but it's coming and it's not going to be pretty. I want to move on to another topic, though, which I've been wondering about, because if I spoke to you, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months ago, you've really gotten this sort of deflation cycle right. But I think there's one thing that's sort of missing, which is, I don't remember if you said it explicitly, but I would have thought that you would expect the 2s-10s curve to be deeply inverted by now, or to have inverted and then maybe started to steepen again. We really haven't seen any sustained 2s-10s inversion. So does that mean we're just not at that point in the cycle yet? Or does it mean that we could maybe have a cycle where we don't get that historically normal curve inversion?
Well, when I assume when you're saying cycle, you mean a recessionary cycle, by, you know, because that's typically what you see when the cash 2s-10s inverts. And as you say, we've sort of been hanging out. I mean, I know people go, oh no, you should look at 3 months, 10 years, or you should look at overnight 10 years. So there's all, people have their own favorite sort of iteration. But if we go with the more traditional one, which I would agree with you, is the 2s-10s, we haven't got there yet. We haven't gone negative. And if you go back into the 80s, that's traditionally what we have needed before we see the recession, right? So in the late 80s, 2000, and 2006, 2007, we went into negative territory. And thus far, we've kind of avoided it. Now, what's interesting is if, and this is less easy for retail investors to watch, but if you look at the forward curve and you look at the forward swaps curve, 2s-10s, so 2 years rates and 10-year rates 2 years forward, you'll actually see that that got to basically zero. And that actually is a pretty damn good indicator of recessionary behavior. It doesn't actually go negative, that one. It only goes to zero. And we did get there. So I think within fixed income, it's possible to argue that there are signs of what would be a recessionary price action. But let's be honest, Eric. I mean, the Fed has just made it absolutely equivocally clear that they intend to punt the cycle, right? They came out and said, you know, the overriding ambition last FOMC was to extend the cycle. And if that happens, then 2s-10s as a bull steepener, right, where 2-year yields drop significantly relative to 10-year yields, isn't the right trade. Because at some point, what's going to happen is you may get a curve steepener, but you'll get a bear steepener as the long end sells off. And, you know, we build up that inflationary pressure and you have this highly easy Fed, which is what we seem to have at the moment, that is tent to run it hot. Well, to go back to your inflation comments, you may get a steepener in that environment, but you'll get a bear steepener as the long end sells off. So right here, right now, I'm less, you know, I've been playing the forward steepener. It's worked reasonably well. It's moved a lot more than the cash steepener, which is a bit sluggish. I'm watching it. I do think as we come up to the FOMC meeting that there's a danger of a bit of a sell-off in fixed income. I think there's an awful lot priced in. And by September, may not be this meeting, but certainly by September, we'll know whether the Fed is still going to deliver. I mean, the market is still essentially betting on 3 to 4 cuts. I don't think the Fed is even close. So to go back to your original question, the 2s-10s curve hasn't yet flagged the recession. Certainly the cash curve hasn't flagged the recession. And what really happens from here, I think one's got to look behind just the pure levels of the curve. Because right here, it's not clear to me whether we're going to get a bull or a bear steepener. If the Fed punts the cycle successfully, and little question, as I said, short term, a little worried about them delivering it and a bit of a volatility in the market as if perhaps they disappoint the market short term. But ultimately, if they're determined to deliver, you may actually not get a bull steepener, which is what you would get heading into recession. You may actually get at least initially, a bear steepener. Because if they're just intent to let this thing run hot and they successfully ease sufficiently to do that, then the long end to me is very vulnerable. And it goes back to exactly that inflation comment of yours.
I want to come back to the bear steepener in just a minute. But first, let's talk about the precedent and expectations in the market around recessions being preceded by curve inversions. Certainly, there's very, very strong historical data that says if you go back, you know, post-war recession since the 1950s, such a strong precedent that you see curve inversions before recessions. But hang on, time out. When have we ever, post-war or any or pre-war for that matter, had the degree of central bank intervention that we have today? So, you know, if the Fed essentially owns the curve, does that really make it an apples-to-apples comparison? Is it relevant to say that you need to have that inversion? Or could it be that the unprecedented degree of Fed intervention allows you to get all the way to the recession without ever having seen an inversion?
Right. And I think, I mean, it's not my base case that we have a recession, but I guess it's possible that we can get in there. I mean, to me, the more important, and I've been thinking about this, you know, mulling it over in my head, is to really, is the bond market as important as it was? Right? Because, you know, you and I grew up in a world where we were told, watch the bond market. Bond market's the more intelligent of the two markets. And there was no question that if you go back in time, it was. But I think things have started to change. And don't get me wrong, it's not that I think the people in the bond market have got stupid. I think that the focus of central banks has shifted. So let me explain. So in an inflationary world where central banks are targeting inflation, their metric of success is the bond market. You know, what's the long end of the curve doing? Are overall levels of rates commensurate with me maintaining my inflation target, et cetera, et cetera? And that was certainly the case up until, let's say, the very late 90s, early 2000s. Because I think with the put, when Greenspan introduced the put in 1998 and came to the aid of the equity market, that we had a regime shift. You can see it in price correlation between bond and equity prices, for example. Very, very significant shift in correlations. It used to be in the old world that bond prices, not yields, prices and equity prices were positively correlated. They used to go up and down together because you were fighting inflation, and only in sort of stable, controlled environments of inflation did equities do well. What typically would happen is when inflation got out of hand, bond prices would fall and so would equities. And then in 98, as I said, things started to change and we moved into a world where central banks weren't fighting inflation, but they were fighting deflation. And in deflationary environment, Eric, my thought process is actually the equity market becomes more important. It certainly becomes the metric of success that central bankers use. And so to me, and we've seen this certainly since the GFC, time and time again, it's been the equity market that leads the way. right? So this is something, Eric, that we've considered. For example, inside the investment committee, the first episode, I talked about shorting the bond market in 2016 and what led me to do that. Well, one of the factors that led me to do that was the rally in risk assets that we saw starting in early 2016. So the Fed, Janet Yellen, we've had all the disruption at the end of 2015. She goes off to Davos. She meets all her peers. They all collectively panic. They come out in early January and they unleash another wave of reflation. And risk assets led by the equity market take off. And the bond market just sits there because we're still in this sort of easing mode and they're held by the shape of the curve and by the carry and so on and so forth in those trades. And there was a significant lack of belief, as I remember it intensely, and the flow that backed that up in the reflation trade from bond investors. They continue to pile into the fixed income market. But as we know, come the middle of the summer, they were proved utterly incorrect. The equity market got it right. And I'm wondering whether, in actual fact, the signals from the bond market, to your earlier questions, are less relevant because we live in a different world now. We live in a very different world now.
Well, indeed, Julian, we live in a central bank-controlled world, and it's a different environment than we're used to. But I want to come back to your comments about the bear steepener, and particularly the backing up of the 10-year yield, because when the 10-year was all the way up at 2.60 or so, and I interviewed you, and it was clear that, you know, the 3.25 or whatever would change direction. And what you said at that time is you said, really, structurally, you were still bearish bonds, expecting higher yields longer term. But you said, look, we're clearly in a cycle and it's got to play out first. But just watch out, because where everybody's going to get caught off guard is they're going to convince themselves that rates are just headed to zero and that Ralph Paul is maybe going to be right. And all of a sudden, everybody's going to get caught wrong footed and there's going to be a reversal like you've never seen before. Are we at the point now? I mean, we're seeing at least the momentum of decay in the 10-year yield going down. It's at least stabilizing a little bit. Are we about to see that reversal? And are you at the point where you would advise your clients to short fixed income or certainly take profit on longs?
So we've certainly taken profit on long positions that we had in fixed income that we put on start of sort of Q4 of last year. So we rode that pretty much all the way down. And, you know, it was a bit of a choppy trend, but basically we were big bulls, you know, looking at the economic data. And I think we're at a sort of decision point here, Eric. As I said, I'm short term, I'm a little concerned that you could get some bond weakness, let's say triggered by a Fed failing to deliver to the very hyped expectations of the market. That's probably just a bout of indigestion. It'll probably get resolved in the next 2 to 3 months, certainly between now and the September FOMC meeting. But a lot depends on the economic data. And don't get me wrong, I'm seeing, you know, certainly when I look at the global manufacturing picture, it doesn't look great to me. Certainly in Europe and in Asia, these trade talks with China just look to be a little bit of a sham. I know we've got some good news here, but it doesn't really look that great. But there are some glimmers of hope in the US. And the big one to me is getting this dollar down. Because if you can start the trend to a weaker dollar, then I think you can get to true reflation. And that's what we saw in 2016. And from true reflation comes true inflation. And that to me would be the big sign to start to get very bearish for the next stage. As you said, so far what we've done is we've had a big run. We're losing sort of that downward oomph in terms of pushing yields even lower. But I think, you know, and we're at a decision point here. You know, if I was a trader, I might be tempted to have a punt at being short fixed income into the Fed meeting. But, you know, for the really decisive next wave, we need dollar weakness, some signs, embryonic. Unfortunately, not in a lot of things that retail investors could trade because they're very Euro-centric. And if you look at things like the DXY, they're not really moving because the euro isn't moving. But outside that, some things are moving. So you're starting to see strength in the Aussie, the Kiwi, some of the other commodity emerging market currencies. So I think there are signs that the dollar may be entering that downward phase. But that to me is the clincher. Because as I said, you go from dollar weakness to reflation to then inflation.
Well, Julian, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview. We look forward to having you back in a couple of weeks for another update. And listeners, be sure to stay tuned to your Macro Voices feed. We've still got Dr. Pippa Malmgren coming up on All Stars this week. We've got another Energy Week episode coming your way, as well as Dr. Peter Warburton coming up as this week's feature interview guest on the flagship Thursday night Macro Voices podcast. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.